Bootery National Park, south of Wollongong in New South Wales, is said to have some of the whitest sand in Australia on its beaches. And the sandy beaches are perhaps what the 450,000 annual visitors most appreciate about the park. But this place has so much more than the tiny sea snails munching on algae in rock pools or the eastern froglets calling in a swamp formed by the groundworks for a nuclear power station that was never built. It has a complex ecosystem. It's jam-packed and varied landscape. It's 1 minute you're in the coastal heath with thick vegetation that's basically impenetrable. Then 50 metres down the line, it turns into woodland and then endangered swamp oak forest and even rainforest. Then back to sandy beach. And this jigsaw habitat means there's a cornucopia of species, mammals, plants and invertebrates that inhabit this peninsula.
Everybody sees the environment through the perspective of extraordinary photography from David Attenborough's shows, and that's wonderful. But there's another side to this, which is in terms of how do you actually understand how animals and plants relate to their environment and how is it changing over time? And with climate change and human disturbance, becomes more and more important to be able to gather the evidence for how things are changing and why.
Professor David Lindenmeyer of the Australian National University has been involved in environmental monitoring of this park since 2002, seeking to fill in the story of this environment between the beauty and majesty of television documentaries with the reality of national park management.
And the most powerful way to do that is to set up experiments that have contrast between, for example, this area, which is a forest, as opposed to a heathland, and a place that's been recently burnt versus places that haven't been burnt. And then to track over time through repeated counts of birds or trapping of small mammals or spotlighting of possums and gliders and compare what happens between places that are burnt and unburnt and how that changes over time. So these kinds of sites which allow us to gather those kinds of data year after year after year to understand how the park's changing and how well the management's going. And that's a critical part of environmental science. So it's a part of understanding the environment that you actually don't get from those glorious programs on Sunday nights on ABC TV.
Chris McGregor, who works for the ANU, works in conjunction with Parks Australia staff and the local Wreck Bay Aboriginal community. He's on the ground to gather data with all of these people, and it means that he's out in the park almost every day, which is both exhilarating and a lot of hard work.
The transect just starts 10 metres in and it goes for 100 metres. And we have the same setup on every single site here in the park, and there's 130 sites.
So we have professional statisticians to really get an understanding of how to best monitor a national park, and Bootery National Park is one of the best monitored parks anywhere in the world.
And how long have you been involved, Dave?
Since 2002. And so it's a relatively long-running program, coming up to 15 years, but in terms of some of the important dynamics of populations, of changes in parks, it's actually quite a short time. And the strength of this is that the longer that it runs, the more important the data become, the more important it is for informing how management is taking place and how effective it is.
Even within national parks, long-term monitoring isn't necessarily the norm. In fact, really comprehensive monitoring like this over a long time, run by Parks Australia, the ANU and the Wreck Bay Aboriginal community, it's actually really rare. We're walking along one of the 130 transects in the Bootery National Park study.
The concept of people getting out in the bush on a regular basis to measure things is increasingly rare. You know, universities are worried about how much it costs. There's massive occupational health and safety things. And everybody's talking about, let's do it by drones and other stuff. But often the real infrastructure that you need to measure the environment is people and skilled people that know how to read the bush, how to read the landscape. And so people like Chris McGregor in our team are incredibly rare individuals that understand how these environments work and make these regular measurements of these extraordinary places.
Every site and every vegetation type is set up the same way, where we've got artificial substrates set up to measure mainly reptiles. So it's a standardised method by which we can make comparisons between the different sites and at another level the different vegetation types. So we several times a year we come round to all the sites and roll over the sleepers, the tin and the tiles, and see what's there. That is a funnel web, quite common, rather obviously deadly invertebrate in the park.
So if we just prod it a little bit, it's likely to just to pop its, it'll pop up on its back legs, and sometimes you can actually see the venom from its fangs.
There's a few species in the park. Yeah, you've got to have a lot of respect for that. Well, it can kill humans, but other animals, they love them. An antechinus would get in there and rip its legs off. It'd be breakfast. They're pretty cool. Such a small animal. Well, here's our...
Oh, a leech.
It's incredible. They're on just about every site. A striped leech. I'm wearing gloves, so I'm not too worried about him being there. Just got the bare remnants of an old antechinus nest here. So they've finished nesting for the season, but they're sometimes find their nests underneath the tin.
The team of scientists are undertaking all sorts of standardised surveys, birds and mammals and invertebrates and plants, as well as observing closely what happens around them. We walk past a huge tree in the bush, still alive, but burnt out, with a base almost like a conch shell that's been burnt so much.
Gee, it's more than 2 metres across at the base.
Yeah.
It's obviously... seen a few fires and survived them.
It has. It's amazing that it can get enough energy up to its top through this base, isn't it, with it's all hollowed out.
Yeah.
Somewhere. The kangaroos have been using the hollowed out area.
And you can see the hollowing from the fire. It's gone right up through the base of the tree and then up into the trunk. And Chris and I recognise that many times these kinds of places are really good for animals like the white-throated tree creeper to nest and shelter in. And we hear the tree creeper all around these kinds of places. They love these patches of forest that have stringy barks with the fissured bark where they can go, mostly collecting ants. It's kind of like an arboreal anteater with feathers. Now the tree actually tells you a bit about the landscape as well. The fire scar that we see here is actually on the other side from the direction of the fire. So what happens is that the fire is coming from the other side of the tree, and then the flames are basically licking around the tree and then burning out the tree from the other side. So this is the leeward side from which the fire has come. So these kinds of things help you understand how the landscape works and how to read the landscape and understand how fire patterns and fire behaviour shapes key parts of the forest, like these butt scars on these amazingly big trees.
And while it's broadly acknowledged that fire is a key and natural part of the ecosystem, when we see a fire moving across a landscape, we automatically think of all the damage it's doing. We see the news reported of all of that destruction. But I'm quickly learning that while bushfire can be catastrophic, it doesn't mean it always is. And scientists and land managers are taking on new ways to manage the park in the light of fires that have occurred, including one in 2003, which burned out half of Bootaree National Park. Thank you. On Off Track, I'm Anne Jones, and today we're at Bootaree National Park on the New South Wales south coast. Up in the area near the old Cape St George Lighthouse in Bootaree National Park. Now, this was a lighthouse, by the way, that was built in the wrong spot and was largely considered to be a navigational hazard rather than a help. Up there, that's where the bristlebird stronghold is. Did you hear the previous episode of Off Track when we heard all about the bristlebird here in this park?
Oh, they're a little brown bird. They're medium-sized with an incredible long tail.
They nest on the ground and don't fly much. And they have spiky bristles on either side of their beak. They're really cute little things.
They're quite characterful. And a real Rufus-y sort of tail.
The tail is somewhere between a blue wren and an emu wren, and they do this duet call in a pair.
And so she maintains some contact with him during the day as they're moving around the territory by duetting with him.
They're endangered, nationally endangered, and so they're a particularly important species to protect.
And their bolt hole was this really thick, heathy bush tucked away near the old lighthouse ruin where no predator could get to them. This stuff is at least 6 foot tall and it's as thick as anything.
Most people would not realise that it was actually incredibly severely burned in 2003. It's absolutely fried. And everyone was very worried about what bristlebirds were going to be able to do and whether or not they were even going to recover or whether it was going to be years before we'd ever see another bristlebird. And what we discovered from being here monitoring before the fire and then after the fire and being able to compare burnt sites with unburnt sites was that within a matter of years, bristlebird populations had rebounded after the fire.
A couple of kilometres away, there is the same sort of environment, this thick, sticky heathland. But here it's been burnt really recently. There's a heap of black bushes, bare sticks of grey and charcoal, up to about belly button height. And then below that, there are sprouting grasses and bushes, which looks like a sweet green meadow beneath the shrub skeletons. And when you stop and stand up to look across the landscape, you can see patches of unburnt area. That's the key for recovery.
So again, this is one of these classic cases where the patchiness of the burn becomes really critical in the way that you manage fire in the systems when you've got endangered species. So in some places, including in Australia, when you have a wildfire, what happens is the fire is naturally patchy, but then a mopping up operation basically comes in and does what's called blackout burning. This is done in the States and parts of Australia. We go and you burn the green bits, and we've discovered that those green bits are actually really important micro refuges for the recovery of the system, particularly some of these more sensitive, fire sensitive animals. And the bristlebird is a classic example of that. So the park has worked with that kind of information, and it simply won't go into the process of doing blackout burning because that's not the way that it needs to manage biodiversity.
What was the logic behind doing blackout burning?
The logic was, well, let's reduce all the fuel across the entire area, reduce the risk of subsequent fire, all that kind of thing. So let's black it all out. It's all taken to zero and then it'll be okay. Whereas that's not how biodiversity responds. Often these little micro refuges are really, really, really important for how the system recovers.
It's just as gorgeous. All of these burnt sticks actually are really beautiful, which is a horrible thing to say.
No, it's not. People should get used to this. Well, they will have to get used to it. If climate change continues as it does, there'll be a lot of burnt areas. The other thing about it, it all adds structure, and that was found to be important in another PhD study looking at Peace and Chestnut lice. It's a native rodent, not closely related to the black rat you see around your houses and gardens in the city, and it seems to specialise in or be adapted to vegetation communities that have been recently burnt. It's a gramnivore, so it eats a lot of grass seeds, and the grasses emerge after fire. So, but it also needs a structure of burnt vegetation, and they build a little nest for themselves, similar to the bristlebirds. It's a little grass nest at the base of trees, but they will also use little rock cavities, so underneath rocks, and they'll also get in underneath vegetation and sometimes underground.
And how would I know that I'm looking at an eastern chestnut mouse as opposed to any other bush rat or anything else?
Yep. Despite its name, it is more a rat-sized animal. It has a furry tail. It's quite a short tail compared to the black rat you'll see at home, which has a very long tail. It has little rounded to triangular-type ears, and the ears, at least in this part of the world, tend to have little golden hairs in them. So they are beautiful animals.
So the key issue here is that when it's burnt, you can see that all around us lots of black stems, but it's opened up the whole area, and so that makes it a particularly dangerous location for some of these animals that normally have cover. So the response to the park when we have these fires is to heavily bait the entire park so that any feral predators that are coming in from the outside have a strong chance of actually taking the baits. And that increases the chances that these animals that normally need cover can survive this very vulnerable stage of a couple of years after fire, and therefore maintain those populations that are critical to be maintained in the park.
One of the natural predators around these parts is the diamond python, a majestic beast, it must be said, an animal that can grow to 3 metres, maybe more, in length. And it has a distinctive large python head topping a muscular body like a boa constrictor. It's a gorgeous gold and black patterned. It is a stunner of a snake.
Being pythons, they detect their prey through the heat sensors in the sides of their jaw, and they'll be hunting day and night, particularly in the summer. So it's not unusual to see them out in the day, and then even at night when you're spotlighting, you come across them. I recall radio tracking bandicoots years ago, and I was closely following a bandicoot, actually, probably 3 metres behind it. And all of a sudden the bandicoot just jumped, made a sideways jump, which is really unusual for a bandicoot. And I didn't see it until I walked up. There was a python that had just struck at it and missed. It was a lucky bandicoot, and the poor old python missed out on a meal.
So this area is one of the strongholds for diamond pythons on the southern east coast. Because of that, we wanted to look at how the animals respond to fire in this system and contrast what animals were doing in burnt areas versus unburnt areas. And the way to do that was radio tracking. Therein lies a problem. You can't put a radio collar around the neck of a snake for obvious reasons. So the solution to the problem fell to my wife, who's a vet. And so what happened was that she came down here with her mobile gas unit. I bought her a mobile gas unit, as you do, for a birthday present one year. And we brought that to here, and we gassed down snakes that were able to be captured in the park, particularly on the rock platforms here, the sandstone rock platforms. And then through a minor operation, basically open up the side of a python and then put in a radio transmitter inside the animal's body wall, and then sew the wound back up again very carefully. So you open up the scales and do the insertion that way, and then fills the animals up with steroids, hold them until they've recovered for a day or so, and then release them, and then track them through the forests and other habitats and compare their movement patterns in burnt versus unburnt areas. And in the burnt areas, the pythons tended to move a lot further. They probably had to find food over larger areas and hunt over more substantial parts of the park relative to those places that were unburnt. So it's really quite an extraordinary story. Chris and one of the members of the local community that worked in our team for a long time, Darren Brown, did a lot of radio tracking of the snakes. And at various stages, various people would be on the beach down at Green Patch. Someone would come past with a radio transmitter and inform them that there was a snake just a couple of metres away. They had no idea was there. But there were some very interesting parts to the story. Yes, there were large movements, but it turned out several things happened. One of them was that there were two groups of snakes, one that spent most of its time in trees hunting mostly ringtail possums, and another group of snakes that spent most of their time on the ground hunting bandicoots and bush rats and the like. So quite different hunting strategies. And at various times what happened was, I remember Chris was at the same time tracking ringtail possums in another terrific study that we'd been doing. A ringtail possum ended up inside a diamond python, so we had two animals with radio transmitters going off at the same time. Yes. that was pretty amazing. So we learnt a lot about the spatial biology of this extraordinary animal right across the park and how it responds to fire and persists in these kind of disturbed environments.
But one of the reasons this place exists is because of thousands of years of indigenous management. And Buderi National Park wouldn't exist if it wasn't for a lot of work by Wreck Bay people in fighting against the development that was going to occur, the nuclear power station. And, you know, they have to be applauded for doing that. And it's a continued struggle. At the moment, they're fighting for sole management of the area. And it's coming about maybe a bit slower than some people would hope for, maybe too fast for others, I think it's an important step, and I hope that they get that support, because it's a beautiful place and a lot of people love it for its beaches, but you know this landscape's incredible, and you won't find many places like it on this very populated east coast of Australia. It's incredible.
So Australians need to embrace this amazing set of natural endowments that the country has and not see them as costs, but in fact vast benefits to the country. You know, the recent trend in the last 10 to 20 years has been one of, and there's a sacred kingfisher calling in the background. A wonderful animal that most Australians have no idea even exists. But, you know, these are iconic places in Australia that Australians need to revere. You go to some places in the world, like parts of South Africa, large parts of the population in South Africa absolutely idolise their national park system because of how much money it brings to their country, how many jobs they provide, the wildlife that these amazing parks hold. And my great desire would for Australians to wake up to the fact that our natural environment is a wonderful part of Australia's culture, its psyche, and increasingly part of our economy, and revere these wild and natural places for all the values that they bring. And on the flip side of that is to make sure that we manage them effectively and efficiently and really well. And the only way that we can do that is to monitor them well, to understand how to manage them really well.
A day dawns at Buderi, where two endangered eastern bristlebirds call out their duet. The most southern known population of eastern chestnut mouse, with its golden ear hairs, scurry back to their nests. A black wallaby thumps through the scrub trying to find safety. And then the sun warms a diamond python who has eaten a squirrel glider with a radio collar on. The pollinators of the afternoon flood onto a 300-year-old grass tree flower spear. And as night falls and the waves relentlessly crash on a rock platform, a snail munches on a bead of seaweed. and you can hear the crabs picking algae off the rocks. And as it gets dark, a powerful owl can be heard, calling across its broad territory. Then, all will be quiet until another day dawns on Bootery National Park. Chris McGregor is a senior research officer from the ANU based at Bootery National Park, and David Lindenmeyer is a professor of ecology at ANU, and together they co-authored a book called Bootery National Park, The Jewel of Jervis Bay. I'm Anne Jones. This is Off Track, and go to the Off Track website right now to see some of the photos of the creatures you just heard, the bristlebird, the diamond python, sea eagles, eastern yellow robins, and the wallabies. And remember to meet me here at the same time next time, because that's when I'll take you somewhere else.
I know that it's not trendy to be evidence-based. I know that we're living in a post-truth world, but evidence is actually really important if you're going to seriously manage important things, precious things like these kinds of environments.